Mitch, keep your eye on me that I don't put this on my briefcase.
I got my name on it. I heard about you. Okay.
Let's do a test.
Excuse me.
We're recording now, Frank.
What was this for?
It's cough drops if you get dry.
All right, we're on a test.
Okay. Cough drops if you get a dry throat.
So we're on a test.
All right.
So I'm going to put on.
Well, let him count to 10. Go ahead, count. Count to 10.
Pardon?
We're going to check the microphone. Count to 10. 1, 2.
Yeah. I have a little problem with hearing now.
Okay. Well, okay. I'll try and.
It's not a matter of talking louder. It's just enunciating.
Okay.
So I can catch the S's and the F's and so forth.
All right. That's good. Okay.
Okay. You want me to count to 10?
No, we got you now. we just want to hear you talk and sit the microphone.
I'll give you 5 seconds.
All right. We're ready.
Okay.
Today is November 27th, 2006. We're at the Amelia Island Museum of History. 233 South 3rd Street in Amelia Island, Florida. The following interview is being conducted as part of the Amelia Island Museum of History's Veteran History Project in partnership with the Library of Congress. We're interviewing Edward, and what's your middle name?
George.
George Velasquez?
Exactly. Very good.
Okay. Date of birth is San Francisco, California, on November 24th, 1921. My name is Frank Reitinger, and I will be interviewing the subject on behalf of the Museum of History. Assisting me is Mac McCaffrey, who will operate the recording equipment. We will now begin the interview. Okay, Ed, tell us about what you were doing before the war started and how you got in and what you did.
Before the war started, before I was drafted, I had graduated high school in 1939 when I was 17 years old, and I'd taken my entrance exam for University of California and passed it, but I decided to work a couple of years to help my parents. So I did go to work, and I worked in San Francisco for 1 year. My dad worked at this place, and he got me on at the Liggett and Myers Tobacco Company. So I learned how to make cigarettes. Matter of fact, that I got a good job there because of my dad, and my dad was a lead man there. So some of my friends who also got on there were jealous because I had this good job of running a machine, making cigarettes. But I couldn't take it after a year, the tobacco dust in the air and so forth. So I quit, and I had a friend in Sunnyvale. I was living in Sunnyvale at the time, who got me employed with what was known then as Joshua Hendy Ironworks. And Joshua Hendy Ironworks was making turbines for the Navy. And then it was taken over by Westinghouse. And to this day, it is part of the Westinghouse Corporation. Now, my job there, I started out as an office boy delivering mail throughout the plant. And the head office boy was drafted. So I got his job, and I became head office boy. So I was in charge of distributing, had two or three young employees, of distributing the mail throughout the plant and maintaining a supply room for office supplies. And I worked there until I was drafted. Now, that's basically it. Further background is that my parents came from Spain. My mother's family was from Malaga, and my father's family was from a small village outside of Sevilla called Morón de la Frontera. Uh-huh. And they came here. I have a tough time remembering the dates, but it was in the early 1900s. And actually, they came to Hawaii because Hawaii needed workers. So they went to Spain and Portugal and hired the men there and brought their families over. And if I remember correctly, the story of my dad was that he and my mother's family were on the island of Kauai. And so they worked there for about 3 years, and as most of them did, there was quite a few. As a matter of fact, I believe that on the ship that my parents came over, there were like 2,200 immigrants. And they all went to Hawaii. And eventually, many of them went over to the mainland, United States mainland. And my dad's family and my mother's family ended in North Beach, which at that time was gradually increasing its population of Italians and Spaniards. And that's what it was for many, many years. It wasn't what it is today, an artist colony, you know. And when I was born, my family was living at 424 Union Street, which is almost at the top of Union Street. Just a few more steps and you can look out at the bay. So that's where I was born.
And that's where you were drafted from?
Pardon?
And you were drafted from San Francisco?
I what?
You were drafted?
No. When I was 5 years old, my dad decided that he did not want to raise his family in San Francisco. And by that time, he had two girls and myself. Later, I had a brother that was born and my sister that's with me today. So apparently the word gets around, or got around, and he moved to Sunnyvale, California, which at that time had to be just a hamlet, maybe a population of 2,000. And my dad built his own house there. And that's where I grew up.
And that's where you were when you got drafted?
Yes. Okay. I was drafted from Sunnyvale because I was working at Westinghouse in Sunnyvale at the time.
And where did you go first when you were drafted?
Okay, when I was drafted, I went to San Francisco. I was inducted there. And I was inducted there on August 15th, 1942. And we were sent from there the very same day to the Presidio of Monterey. And by bus. And we were there about 2 weeks while they processed us, took our IQ tests. And that two-week period, we were marching over the hills of Monterey and so forth. And at that point, I began to hate the sergeants, you know. I mean, I guess they really lorded over recruits. So I went through the processing, and I was assigned to Camp Lee, Virginia. Went across country by train. Arrived in Camp Lee, Virginia, sometime in August of 1942. I can still remember that. I mean, it's still very fresh in my mind. I can still remember lining up and hearing the train whistle in the distance. And I had never been away from home. I mean, the furthest I'd been away from Sunnyvale was Yosemite National Park. Mm-hmm. So all this was a real experience to me. I mean, just going to we'd been to Monterey. The Spanish people used to have picnics out on the beach in Monterey, Carmel. So I'd been there, but I'd never been much farther than that. That's 130 miles from Sunnyvale. So anyhow, that was the point, getting there. And we were assigned 10th. That's where we lived during basic training. And fortunately, I knew a couple of the fellows that came along with me from Sunnyvale. And as a matter of fact, one person lived across the street from me in Sunnyvale. I still remember his name. His name was John Vay. And
do you spell that, please? John what, please?
Pardon?
How do you spell his name?
V-A-I. So I went through my basic training there. For whatever period of time it took, you know, probably 6 weeks, something like that. And finished that, and I was assigned to an office, a personnel office, and worked there for a little while. Now I have to backtrack a second here, because while we were going through basic training, I remember going on weekend passes and things like that, and we went to Petersburg, Virginia for one or two nights, and a couple times to Richmond, Virginia, and those things were all new experiences for me. So so I went to work for this personnel officer, and after a while, it wasn't too long, he asked me if I was interested in going to Officer's Candidate School. And I didn't even know what it was. I had no idea what Officer's Candidate School was. And so he told me, and I says, okay, yeah, you know, I'm interested. Well, I don't understand all this, by the way. I was pretty shy back in those days, you know. So I had to take an oral test to get into OCS. My IQ apparently was okay, was above average. And I'll never forget that experience of standing before three or four officers and having just gone through basic training and that's all, and being at that point only 20 years old. And I have to stand there and answer the questions from them. But then the thing that I really remember, I think there were three officers, a couple colonels. The thing I really remember is when they asked me to give commands, like forward march or left turn march, you know, that sort of stuff. Because I'd had a little trouble with that going through basic training. I couldn't follow the furrows in the field and plowed fields, you know. The lieutenant would say, not that way. So anyhow, I got accepted into OCS. And that was in November of 1942. I think I have a date. I wrote it down. I entered OCS November 27th, 1942. And I was there until I graduated and on February 26, 1943. So it turned out, I thought it was a 90-day wonder, but it turned out to be a 120-day wonder. And I didn't discover that until I wrote these dates down. And going through OCS, so it was an experience. You know what it's like. You said you went through cadet training and so forth, and this whole time that I was going through, I just kept thinking I was going to flop out. I wasn't going to make it. You know, I remember I came down with the measles. And they sent me to the hospital. And then I found out that if I was out for more than a week, I would be kicked out of OCS. Fortunately, I wasn't out. I was out just exactly a week. I went back and I graduated OCS.
What was, how many guys did you lose in your OCS class?
How many did we lose?
Yeah.
You know, I have no idea.
Okay. Because sometimes you hear it's a large number and you never know.
Yeah, I have no idea. I know we lost some. Yeah. But what stays in my mind, way back then, I saw in Life magazine, and I think it was then, maybe it was a little bit later, but of a fellow that had been dismissed from OCS, and they showed him marching or walking across the parade ground with his bag on his shoulder. I must have been while I was going to OCS because I said, gosh, I hope that doesn't happen to me because I can feel how bad he feels. So in any event, I graduated. Then the next thing when you go to OCS is you wonder where you're going to be assigned or what you're going to be assigned to. And there are some things that you just don't want to get into. For example, graves registration. That's where you go out on the battlefield, identify people, or where they recover equipment, tanks and so forth, or even a laundry company. I mean, none of those things anybody wanted. And to this day, I don't know why I was assigned to the Air Corps. I have no idea. That's what everybody wanted. I know I wasn't that smart. I mean, you know, what can you show in OCS that would help the Air Corps? Yeah. I didn't fly about flying. So they sent me, first I went home on leave. And I forgot, I had 2 weeks, I believe, and it's the first time I ever flew an airplane. And I flew a DC-3 across the country. Oh. I had some kind of priority, but I got offloaded in St. Louis and eventually got back on, and it ended up in San Francisco and saw my family. And then I flew back. And as soon as I got back, the very next day, I was assigned to the Salt Lake City Army Air Base for assignment somewhere. I might stop at this point and mention that I enjoyed being at Camp Lee, Virginia, and I had these friends, and, you know, going to Petersburg and Richmond and all those things, it was all fun. I enjoyed the whole thing. At that point, I didn't have to work hard or anything like that. Anyhow, so I went in to see the assignment officer, and he told me that he could give me two choices of where I wanted to be assigned. And one of them was to Blythe Air Force Base in California, and the other was in New Mexico.
Blythe, B-L-Y-T-H?
B-L-Y-T-H. E. Well, I was so homesick that California just sounded wonderful. So they sent me out there. That was the middle of the desert also. You know, I don't know exactly where Blythe is to this day, but it's got to be pretty close to Death Valley or something. I don't know. It just got so hot down there. And when the wind blew, the sand used to come in through your window, the wind, you know, and be all over your blanket and sheets and so forth. And so I went through a couple months of training in quartermaster supply.
Oh, okay.
And I met some more fellows there, got along very well with them and so forth. And my commanding officer there at that time was a Captain Geller, whose picture is in this book as a major.
Would you spell his name, please?
Geller?
Mm-hmm.
G-E-L-L-E-R.
Thank you.
Yeah, he was from Lebanon, Pennsylvania. He was older. I thought he was old. Let's see, 1943? Well, I guess I was 21 years old, 1943, but he was probably about 30. So I thought he was really old. So anyhow, I trained there. And then one day he told me that he had been assigned to Wendover Field, Utah, which I knew nothing of. And he asked me if I would like to go along with him.
Wendover.
Wendover, W-E-N-D-O-V-E-R. Am I being too detailed?
No, you're fine.
No, you're fine.
Sure?
Plus, we can get a lot of stuff at the end and not tie up the tape with it. Right, so.
Pardon?
Yeah, you're fine. You're fine. That's good.
I don't want to extend this.
No.
I'm just trying to do this in chronological order.
That's where it works best that way.
I said, I'll go along with you. So he went up there first, and I followed later, and I got there in May. Yeah, it was May of 1942. I graduated in February of 42, went down there for 3 months, Blythe. So that was in May of 1942.
43? 43.
42. Yeah. No. I was drafted in 42. Right. 43 is when I graduated. Yeah. I missed Pearl Harbor in 41. Mm-hmm. So I went there. I got there in May. And I still remember walking into the officers' club, and he's sitting there with some other people. All this is strange. In any event, turned out to be a very nice person. And we had a quartermaster supply building of our own with our own offices. And so he introduced me to the rest of the people. And he assigned me as my job was, analyzing and procuring and distributing food, subsistence. That was my job. And fortunately, I had a very, very good sergeant who knew all this stuff, Sergeant McKnight. He was part Indian. And so I was in charge of three block-long warehouses, packed to the ceiling, and a cold storage plant, and a sales store where you sold to the people on the base. So, and at that time, the Army had switched over to more of a commercial type of accounting as opposed to Army accounting. So I was fortunate to learn that, the new type of accounting. And became adept at it. And now I think that base had like 15,000 personnel.
Were the B-29s already there?
At that time, the B-29s were there.
They were there.
So from that period, that was my job. It was a very nice base. Theater, swimming pool, bowling alley, library. Yeah, very, very nice. We used to go on marches out in the desert, up in the mountains, the foothills. Dances, officers' club dances, things like that. Salt Lake City for weekends. Eli, Nevada for weekends. Wells, Nevada, which was only like 40, 50 miles from there. But the other place was Elko, Nevada.
What? How do you spell it, please?
E-L-K-O.
E-L-K-O.
And from time to time, we'd go to Salt Lake City, which was a beautiful city. Really enjoyed that. Stayed at the Hotel Utah, which is a beautiful hotel, and they had a roof garden. They served their dinners and so forth. And I met my wife there. As a matter of fact, the fellow that I was rooming with, his Captain Christensen, it's in that book, one day asked me if I wanted to go out with a woman that he knew. So I said, sure. And it turns out that he knew her from Midville. That's where my wife came from. He lived around the corner from my wife. So that's how I met my wife, was by John Christensen introducing me to her.
John Christensen?
Christensen, yeah. That's C-H-R-I-S-T-I-A-N. S-E-N. So my wife and I, you know, went around together, and we got married there on May 5th of 1945. I went overseas on May 15th, 1945.
Wow.
Went over to Hamilton Air Force Base in California, from there to Pearl Harbor, to Johnston Island, to Kwajalein, and Tinian.
Wow.
I think it probably took a couple of days.
Oh, sure. Yeah. What kind of airplane did you fly over on?
C-54.
Okay, I know we had a lot of C-54s.
There's a squadron in the group, yeah. C-54s.
Yeah.
Of course, that was the biggest airplane I'd ever been in.
Yeah. Okay.
Well, it's the thing that I remember about the trip from Hamilton was having breakfast at Hamilton Airfield and then having breakfast in Hawaii again. Yeah. I've never been through that.
Mm-hmm. Were you the initial cadre that...
Pardon?
Were you the initial bunch that went to Tinian, or were there air groups or air squadrons already there? Or were you the first ones in there?
Our group?
Yeah.
The entire group?
Yeah.
You're talking about the group?
Yeah.
Were we the first ones in the island?
Okay, they already had other bomb groups there, evidently.
Pardon?
They already had other bomb groups.
Oh, yeah, okay. Yeah.
But you had your own special area.
That's right.
Okay.
Yeah.
Tell us about that.
I don't remember too much about it. There's some nice pictures in this album of the bomb group area, the headquarters area. There's one picture in there of our squadron, the 1027th Air Materiel Squadron. And I'm sitting at a desk doing some paperwork. But I didn't know too much about the flying. I mean, what was going on? We had no idea. Well, none of us had any idea what the mission was. Apparently, some of the people in the bombing in the squadron, the bomb squadron, were told that it was a special mission, and a special weapon, but they did not know. The flight crews did not know, from what I read and have heard, that they were going to drop an atomic bomb until they were in the air.
Now, what was your job over there?
I was a supply officer over there.
But were you still doing procurement for foods? And
you know, I've been trying to remember. My mind is so hazy as to what I did when I was there. But I had to be doing that.
But that was such a big base. You must have had a harbor and ships.
No, I didn't take care of the island.
I know. I understand that. But, I mean, just to support the base plus your group, they must have had a harbor and ships coming in all the time with supplies.
Oh, they did. Yeah. You know, as a matter of fact, they had the harbor there is where the Indianapolis was carrying atomic material.
Carried the bomb parts.
Yeah. So
you didn't deal with the ships at all, did you?
No.
Okay.
No, I didn't deal with the ships. I didn't deal with outside parties. You know, when I was at Wendover buying food, I dealt with the Ogden Depot, and I dealt with, when it came to fresh food, fruits and vegetables and dairy products and so forth, dealt with individual companies.
Okay.
I didn't do any of that at Wendover. I mean, at Ontinian.
Yeah.
And when I think back, and I've given this a lot of thought, because I said, what did I do while I was there? You know, I must have done something, but I can't remember what any of the other people did either.
But you were receiving parts, engine or airplane parts, and just regular supplies, and food.
No,
and
we didn't handle airplane parts.
Oh, you didn't handle
it? No, quartermaster supplies.
Okay.
Ciao.
We had an ordnance company.
Okay.
So that's why this is a composite group.
Had all the different companies.
Yeah, we had medical. We had our own military police. Ordnance. The bomb squadron. And all of us were in the Air Force. I mean, I wore the Air Corps insignia. I don't know if there was... Well, apparently there must have been an official transfer, but...
The Army Air Corps, yeah. Was it still called the Army Air Corps then?
Yes, yeah. Part of the Army Air Corps.
Well, then what happened to you after they dropped the bomb and go on from there? What happened to you?
Well, after they dropped the bomb... We heard about it, and it came back. The first plane on August 6th came back directly to Tinian. The second plane was running out of fuel because they couldn't find a target. And when they eventually bombed, they came back to Okinawa, then Tinian. So they had a ceremony when came back. And I don't know that I went down to it. I don't remember. But where Colonel Tibbetts was awarded the Distinguished Service Medal, which I think is the second highest medal, Congressional Medal being the highest. They had this as soon as the plane landed. And the Major, the General Spatz, who was the head of the Air Force at that time, presented the medal. So we hung around for a while. This was August. See, the first bomb was dropped August 6th. The second one was dropped August 9th. And Japan surrendered on August 11th. Although in the book somewhere, you'll find where they state that after August 11th, after Japan had surrendered, that we sent four planes over to bomb Japan. Because apparently they weren't quite sure. And those, as far as anybody knows, those were the last four planes to bomb, the last four B-29s to bomb Japan.
After the bomb drops.
And my experience on the island, you know, you try to think of something that happened that you could. I had some good friends. You know, this Michael Anthony, who wanted to be a doctor. I don't know if he ever became a doctor or not. I lost sight of most. I had some problems after the war, and my wife got cancer and things like that. And I had a child. See, I had a child that was born on January 30th. 1946. I forgot to mention that.
And you were
that.
Still gone. How long were you over there? When did you leave Tinian?
46?
Yeah, 46.
I left Wendover May 15th, 45. And I left Tinian to come back on October 17th, 45.
Okay, so about 2 months after they dropped the bomb, you were rotated back.
And doing all this, I was surprised that I was there that long after we dropped the bomb. Anyhow, we came back by ship. So I wasn't as elite coming back as I was going over.
Well, how was the troop ship coming back?
You know, I don't remember anything about that. I don't remember a thing about that. How could this be?
Well, that's a long time ago. You know, you came back. Where did you come back to?
Let's see, that's 17, 14. That was 18 days on the ship.
Yeah.
I don't remember anything. I don't remember eating there or sleeping in the bunks or whatever. Now I have a pretty good memory.
Yeah.
What was your question?
Where did you come back to when you came back?
What did I come back to?
Where did you come back to?
I ended in Roswell, New Mexico. Sent there when we disembarked. I was sent to Roswell. Was there for a little while. Well, actually, I went on terminal leave like March 1st.
Of 46.
Yeah, 46. Let's see, March 1st. 46. So I was in Roswell at that time to go on terminal leave. But I went up to Lowry for separation.
To where, please?
L-O-W-R-Y, Lowry. Colorado.
I had a military occupation code you might want. 4419, or O-0 for officer, I guess, 4419.
And that was quartermaster?
Yeah.
4419.
And I figured that my total active duty within the Army of the United States, whatever, was from August 15th, 42, till March 24th, 46. That's when my terminal leave was up. Mm-hmm. And I also figured that when my OCS period was 11/27/42 to 2/26/43. I may have said that earlier. My serial number, officer serial number, is 015-88936.
Never forget that.
Never forgot it.
Never forget that.
However, I had an enlisted number also, and I never remembered that one, even at the beginning. But I think one reason that I don't forget mine is that I had a footlocker with my number stenciled on it in the front. And I had that locker in my garage for years.
Yeah.
And every time I came in the door, it was staring me in the face.
So after you get out of the service, what did you do for a career?
What did I do?
Yeah.
There's a fruit cannery in Sunnyvale called Libby McNeil and Libby, big company. And the assistant superintendent, a person by the name of Fred Imhoff, I-M-H-O-F-F, had been a friend of mine before I went into service. He was in charge of boys' clubs in Sunnyvale. And I was the head of one boys' club for him. So I went and saw him about getting a job. And he said that he could get me on in the office. And that, in time, I could probably be office manager. So sounded pretty good to me. So I went to work for Libby McNeil and Libby. Pretty low salaries in those days. That's 1946. I think I was getting $1 an hour. And anyhow, my job there was, I'd come out of the service, I was making about $300 a month.
Mm-hmm.
As a first lieutenant, subsistence, and lodgings. So it came to about $300 a month. So I was working on time cards. And one day I was working on the janitor's time card, and I saw that he was getting $1.25 an hour. And I thought, this does not sound right to me that I would get a dollar an hour and he gets a dollar and a quarter. So I went in to see the superintendent, the number one man, and I had known him sketchily before the war. And I told him, I said, Mr. Meineke, I says, I need a raise. He says, why, Ed? I says, well, I says, you know, I'm making a buck an hour. That's not enough to support a wife and a child. I said, the janitor's making a dollar and a quarter. He says, yeah, but the janitor's been with us 25 years. Never forget that.
Yeah.
I said, well, Mr. Meineke, I think I have to quit. So I resigned right then and there. I had a friend working for Pan American Airways, Pan American World Airways in San Francisco. And I went to visit him one day, and he said he could get me on at Pan American. So I went to work at Pan American as a telephone sales agent. Now, I hadn't gone to college, okay? I just graduated high school before I went into service. So he got me on at Pan American as a telephone sales agent, and shortly after that, my wife came down with cancer. And she went back to Salt Lake City, or Midvale, Utah, from where she came, where her family lived, and where her doctor was, and went back there and had a mastectomy. Now, mastectomy, in those days, you didn't even talk about them. So she had a radical mastectomy, where there was nothing left after they removed the breast. So I went back there and stayed with her for a while. And Pan American, my having worked for them not very long, I don't know, a month or 2 months, was good enough to give me time off and pay me to go back there. Yeah. Very, very good.
Okay. So your career was with Pan American?
I stayed at Pan Am. I went to work in 46 and stayed through 1954.
Okay.
During which time I rose in position and became assistant reservation and ticket office manager. At the same time, I was going to night college in San Francisco. At the same time, I was living in Sunnyvale, California, and commuting by train. At the same time, I had a wife and a child. And I was going to night college about two or three nights a week. And, you know, many times I'd catch a 10 o'clock train to go home. A couple times I'd catch a midnight train to go home. But anyhow, I went through that. But gradually I started cutting down the nights. Instead of three nights a week, I went two nights a week. Then I got down to one night a week. And anyhow, eventually I had taken all the accounting subjects and the business law. I didn't graduate. At Pan Am, as I was gradually going up in position, instead of a telephone sales agent, I became a counter sales agent, where everybody wants to be a counter sales agent. I mean, I was right there on the, if you know San Francisco, the corner of Stockton and Maiden Lane, right across from the Union Square Garage.
Oh, yeah.
That was Pan Am's office there in the corner, big glass windows. And we used to work there at the counter. And one of the funniest things I ever saw as a sales agent was a Chinese coming in from Central America, Panama or whatever, and talking Spanish. I mean, better than I, because I'm not fluent in Spanish. I can speak it and understand it, but that's really odd, you know, coming from a Chinese face. I hadn't been through that.
Yeah.
So anyhow, that's... I terminated my employment with Pan Am in 1954. I told them I wanted to quit on December 31, 54, because I wanted to start an accounting business in Sunnyvale on January 1, 1955, which is the beginning of tax season. And tax seasons are not that big at that time as they are today, but still, if you had a certain income coming from the beginning, mm-hmm. if you got the business. But I was known in Sunnyvale, and there was only one other accountant. Now, grammatically, there was only one other accountant. So I quit. Actually, Pan Am well saw my bonus because I quit. Mm. I had a bonus of like $500 coming.
Wow.
And I really needed that money. And I had a friend who had just become an attorney, and he sued Pan Am for me and got my $500, but he got half of it. So, anyhow, I quit Pan Am. I started my accounting business. Through the grace of a grandfather clause in the California law, which has stopped granting public accountant license, what they call PA licenses. But I got one through the grandfather clause, and having had some experience in the Army in accounting. So I practiced as a PA for several years. But I immediately recognized that that was not going to go anywhere when I was competing against CPAs. So I started studying for the CPA exam on my own, took the exam, passed it, but I hadn't had the experience that they require, 3 years experience with an accounting firm and auditing, stuff like that. The only experience I had was my own, where I started my own accounting firm. So they made an exception and said I had to take an oral exam. If I passed that, I could be a CPA. Here's another oral exam after the Army. So I went up there and I took the oral exam. The guy asked me questions and so forth, and I passed it and I became a CPA.
Wow. So were you you were a CPA for your career until you retired?
Was I what?
You were a CPA until you retired.
Yeah, well, that, in a way, yeah. I became a CPA in 1963. My certificate was delayed because of President Kennedy's assassination.
Oh, wow.
I couldn't believe it. I'm waiting for this certificate. Anyhow. And I was a CPA until I sold my practice in February 1978. And but in the meantime, I had accumulated partnership interest in two travel agencies. So after I terminated my business, I still did whatever accounting they required.
Oh, okay.
But that was really minimal work. I had hardly any work at all. And then I became a partner in a boatyard. And that didn't work out too well, so I sold my interest out. And then I got rid of all my interests, maybe 3, 4, or 5 years later, sold out both travel agencies sold out. So I was out of that. I sold out of the boatyard, and I started playing golf 6, 7 days a week.
All right.
Got my handicap down to an 11. Eventually ended with a handicap of about 18 or 19 or 20.
Is that what got you to Nassau County, to Fernandina? When you decided in retirement you were going to play golf? How did you get here?
Okay, that was one of the things. I mean, that was... I got here. I was living in Los Altos, California. I'd moved there in 1976. Had a very nice home there, about 2,500 square feet, Spanish style. My My wife still was alive, had cancer. She had gone in remission. But I wanted her to have a better home and a better location and so forth. So we got this house. And so she was okay. But then she got it back in 19... I bought the home in 76. And she got it back around then. She died in 1981. July of 1981. So I stayed there, living in the same home, which I liked very much. Los Altos is a very nice town. It's away from the traffic and so forth. And you ever been there, in that area? And I sold, well, in 1976, my son and I were talking, and he said, you know, you ought to come live on a media island. I discussed that. At the time, he was with Delta Airlines. He was a captain with Delta. And he had two homes, one on a media island and one on Alpharetta. Well, actually, in Atlanta or Alpharetta, I forget where. He had three or four homes up there. One was real close to the Atlanta Athletic Club. Really nice club that he belonged to. So anyhow, discussed it, you know, why don't you move to the island and so forth. And I debated it because I had a lot of friends back there, all these people. I'd been in Los Altos Country Club about 26 years. Wow. So I had a lot of friends there. If I didn't, I knew them. So I debated that and so forth. But in any event, after much thought, I moved here. And when I first came here, I lived for 1 year on a condominium at called Ocean Place, on Amelia Island Parkway, third or fourth floor. Beautiful view of the ocean and so forth.
When was this place?
Pardon?
When was this you came to the Ocean Place?
I'm not hearing.
When did you come to Ocean Place?
Oh, well, okay. Actually, I got it back. I sold my home towards the end of August, like August 31st. I moved to, first I went to Atlanta, stayed there for a couple of weeks with my son, Alpharetta. Came down to Amelia Island the day before 9/11, 9/10.
That was 91.
Yeah. God, what was that correct? No, 2001.
2001.
I'm 2001.
Yeah. Excuse me.
I knew it was a one.
I mean, all of a sudden, I said, my God, I said,
On September 10th, 2001, you came to Amelia. Okay.
And at first, I knew of that 9/11. As I was in bed, 7 a.m. or whatever, and my son says, hey, Dad, you got to come out and watch this on TV. So I got out there just in time to see this second airplane hit the building. That's the first I knew of it. So in any event, I was there. I stayed there for a while.
And where was that again, please?
Pardon?
Where was that again?
At my son's home on Amelia Island.
And was that at Ocean Place?
No.
I'm sorry.
That's when I came to the island. I was trying to get at that. See, in other words, I came to the island on September 10th.
Right.
And I stayed there until September 30th. Because on October 1, I moved to Ocean Place. Okay?
Right. So you've been here ever since then?
I lived there for 1 year. I didn't like it. I didn't like the condominium. I didn't like the lack of people around because they use it for transients, you know, so not going to be there during the bad part of the year and so forth. And yeah, you could go walk on the beach every day, but that's quite a walk to get to the beach from there. And I just didn't like it. I didn't like the condominium. I didn't like the kitchen. You know, there were a lot of things I didn't like about that. The ocean, I could see the ocean back in California. You know, I wasn't very far from the Pacific Ocean. So I moved. And I moved. And I rented again. I wanted to buy a house, but well, I'm tired of housing. You know, so I moved. I moved to 397 Portside Avenue, Fernandina Beach. Okay, 32034.
Mm-hmm.
A nice place, nice neighborhood, not too far from the beach. But I still wanted my own place. So I bought a villa, what they call them villas, at what they call, God, it's Harrison Cove, which is off First Coast Highway there. And I moved in there on January 27th of this year.
Okay.
And that brings you up to date.
Well, that's it. So you enjoy Nassau County. You're glad you live here.
I have changed a little bit. I was depressed when I came here. I mean, leaving all my friends behind, leaving the country club behind, all that sort of stuff. I literally became a little bit depressed. But I joined the club here, the one at the Ritz-Carlton, the golf club at Amelia Island, that's what it's called. I joined that. And I hurt my arm. I tore a tendon, the main tendon, from the elbow to the shoulder. And I couldn't swing a club. I couldn't, for a year, I couldn't play golf. So when I started trying to play golf again, I was so bad. I said, I quit. I'm not going to play any more golf. No more golf. I quit the club. I'd given them only a down payment, so there was no penalty. And so I forget what the question was.
Well, that's how you got here. We'll wrap it up, unless there's anything you want to say more about your time in the military.
I know what I want to say. I just want to say that I like the island very much.
Okay.
I really objected to the heat. But I spent 10 days in Auburn, California this year, where they had a heat wave of 10 days. I was there more than 10 days. Heat wave of 10 days where the temperature was over 100 and up to 110.
Wow.
And I never want to go through that again. You don't go through that here. It's hot, but it's not that.
Not that hot. Yeah.
So, yes, you can wrap it up unless you want something else.
Unless there's anything else you want to add about it. Mac, do you have any questions?
Well, you think I left anything out?
No, I think you got it all.
I thought it was excellent.
Too much?
All right.
Okay, we are done.
Thank you for sharing your recollections with me for the benefit of our nation. And this concludes the interview with Ez Velasquez. All right.